It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Since 1980, the population in the U.S. has grown by a third, but its prison population has grown by 800%.
In a speech this morning, Attorney General Eric Holder called for reforms in the criminal justice system. He says they want to do away with minimum sentences for some drug-related crimes.
Holder said that high levels of incarceration in the U.S. for drug-related crimes have been ineffective and are unsustainable for taxpayers.
In this segment, we want to hear from you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Post on the Central Time Facebook page or send an email, talk@WPR.org. Do you agree with the Attorney General? Do you want to get rid of these mandatory minimum sentences for what they're describing as low-level non-violent drug offenders?
800-642-1234 is that phone number. Eric Holder said in a speech today that incarcerating low-level non-violent drug offenders is imposing a significant economic burden totaling about $80 billion in 2010 alone.
So, again, we're looking for your calls. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Send an email, talk@WPR.org. Lower sentences for some drug offenders. Do you think that is a bad idea? Sends the wrong message. Do you think it's a good idea? Will save us some money in the prison system, maybe affect the lives of people affected by this. By the way, coming up after this call-in segment, we'll talk about the decline of movie westerns.
That's right. And whether or not that's good or bad for us, our guest says that the westerns are worth saving. We're going to learn why after about 4:15, so stay tuned. We are waiting for your calls at 1-800-642-1234, talking about Eric Holder's speech today. He also is calling for an expansion of a program called Compassionate Release. This would be for elderly inmates who did not commit violent crimes and have served significant portions of their sentences already. So that's another fold in this conversation.
To the phones now at 800-642-1234. We have Kurt with us in South Milwaukee. Kurt, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I would like to agree with the Attorney General, I suppose. I think a lot of people are getting some crazy jail times for things that are hardly illegal and honestly are legal in some other states when it comes to recreational marijuana use. I don't think people should be held accountable on the same levels as hard narcotics like heroin and cocaine and crack use and stuff like that. That was pretty much all I have to say. I guess I'll listen to the rest off the air.
Great. Thanks a lot for your call, Kurt. Appreciate it.
We'll talk next to John in Appleton. Hi, John.
Hi.
What do you think about this?
I think it's a good thing. I think by keeping these mandatory minimum sentences, we're hurting ourselves and we're hurting the prisoners. One of the points the penal system is supposed to be rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thanks a lot for the call, John. Appreciate it. By the way, our lines were briefly full there. If you were just trying to get in, you can get in at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. A line open for you.
And, in fact, Eric Holder did say that he would like to increase the use of drug treatment programs as an alternative to incarceration, too. So that's some information for you there, John. We'll go next to Nick in Greenfield. Hi, Nick.
Yeah, hi there. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Thanks for taking my call. And I just wanted to call in and say that I'm a senior citizen, and when they first started with those laws, I was screaming up and down, like yelling at the television, that they were stupid. It was like trying to kill a fly with a shotgun. You did more damage with the holes you made in the wall than trying to kill the fly. But nobody listened to me.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for sharing your story. I'll go ahead.
And John in Windsor, we have you on the line. Hi, John.
Yes, I would like to see shorter sentences for nonviolent drug offenders, but longer sentences for white-collar criminals, because the reality is that the white-collar criminals are the ones that are really causing havoc in society. And I just think a lot of times that, drug offenders many times do not have access to things such as education, other opportunities to improve on their lives. And you take a look at the number of individuals incarcerated, the African American population is a huge number, and those are people that just don't have resources, and they're the ones that are end up serving.
John, thanks a lot for your call. We're surveying your thoughts, your reactions to Attorney General Eric Holder's announcement today, wanting to reform the criminal justice system. The big part of it is getting rid of minimum sentences for some drug-related crimes. What they're describing, a lot of the quotes are low-level, non-violent offenders at the federal level, but also encouraging similar things at state and local levels. Back to the phones now. We have Terry in Prairie du Chien. Terry, hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Well, good. What do you think about this?
Well, I think that if they're gonna do the crime, they should do the time, but it should be maybe more of a work release or a Huber type thing where they actually serve the time, but they actually do some good to the community. Maybe that's part of the rehabilitation process. Get them off the cycle, and they can break the drug habit, break their drug dealing habits, and maybe become useful society members.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call, Terry. Appreciate it. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on this idea of lowering sentences for low-level nonviolent drug offenders.
And just to share some more information with you about Eric Holder's speech today, this is according to the New York Times. Mr. Holder deplored the moral impact of the United States' high incarceration rate. Although it's only 5% of the world's population, has 25% of its prisoners, he noted. So we're asking for your thoughts for the next couple of minutes at 1-800-642-1234. Mike in Black River Falls. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you doing today?
I'm well. How are you?
Very good. I like what he's come up with the getting rid of the minimum sentences, but why haven't we as a society gone to get rid of putting people, incarcerating people for crimes that are nonviolent, basically non-victimless, or people would call them white-collar crimes, put them on work release or community service or helping out the community? Enron would be a good example. They threw him in prison, threw him away, but he's got financial expertise. Why couldn't you just put him with a lifelong thing of helping the community or the government with his expertise rather than throw him away and lock and throw the key away?
Gotcha. Thanks a lot, Mike, for the call. Next on the line, we have Andrew in Kenosha with us. Andrew, hi.
Hi. I think we ought to extend the time that they serve in jail. They ruin a ton of people's lives. Even the movie stars that are super rich, they wind up losing everything. You know, so how is a person that gets addicted, and it starts out as marijuana maybe, but then it's a stepping drug. Here in Wisconsin, we have a huge problem with, meth and heroin they've had on how many kids have gotten killed and stuff like that. And when they start talking about nonviolent, well, some of these crimes, yeah, they had the gun, they just didn't use it. Well, what's the difference there? They could have used the gun, they chose not to. So because you didn't shoot somebody, but you held up a grocery store or a fast food restaurant, but you didn't shoot anybody, you're nonviolent?
Gotcha. Andrew, thanks to you, and thanks for everyone who called in to share your thoughts, sounding off on this announcement from the Attorney General today. We're going to check the headlines now, and then we'll talk about classic Western films, why they seem to have gone away, and why, according to our next guest, that's bad news. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. Right now, we take a look at trends in movies.
For decades, the Hollywood Western was a tried-and-true genre. It seemed American moviegoers couldn't get enough grizzled cowboys and shootouts at the saloon. Now that might be changing. Big-budget Westerns like The Lone Ranger, Cowboys and Aliens, and Jonah Hex have tanked at the box office in recent years.
According to our next guest, that's not a good thing. He says we've relied on Westerns to teach us our history and reflect on our current politics and our place in the world. We can't afford to lose that mirror now. Michael Agresta is a freelance writer based in Los Angeles. His piece, How the Western Was Lost and Why It Matters, appeared in The Atlantic, and we have a link to it on the Central Time Facebook page. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sure. Well, tell us, for you, what makes a Western a Western?
Well, the biggest thing for me is the engagement with our history. You know, for me, the Western is my favorite movie genre. I know we all have our favorites. I don't want to tear down anyone else's, but I think the Western is really special if you are a history buff, or if, like me, you really believe that you have to understand your history if you want to understand the world around you and even, you know, have a working society.
Mm-hmm. So you had pointed out in your article that it's Westerns really aren't the box office hits that that you might expect them to be. Why do you think they're flopping?
Yeah, it's been a bit rough lately. You know, Jonah Hex, as you mentioned, The Lone Ranger, Cowboys and Aliens. And I see it as a cyclical thing that happens, you know, as America's place changes in the world, our appetite for this sort of engagement with our history changes. And right now we're at a time when, you know, complicated questions have to be asked, and that might not be what a mass audience wants to go and, you know, watch and eat popcorn and, you know, have a escapist night out doing.
Well, can you give us some specifics as people head out to the theaters and take in those Westerns? What history lessons might they be, let's say, burdened with that they don't want to see right now?
Well, a lot of my article focused on The Lone Ranger, which, you know, just came out last month, and I thought it was a really interesting movie. I wouldn't say it was a great movie, maybe not even a good movie, but it really tried to do something. It tried to engage especially with the Tonto character, which there's sort of two different layers of history with Tonto. There's, you know, they develop a backstory which involves a massacre of a Native American village, and then they also try to play into Tonto's history as a character, which was a sort of a Native American stereotype in the 1920s. So they were trying to engage with both of those, and they made some really interesting moves, trying to both have fun and acknowledge those episodes in history. But, you know, in my opinion, it was just, they were just, the moves are just a little too difficult to land, maybe.
Mm. In what ways?
Well, I don't want to give away too much of the movie. I'll give away the first 5 minutes. How about that? The first scene is set in the 1920s, and a young boy in a Lone Ranger mask wanders into a sideshow at a fair of some sort, and Johnny Depp is there in Tonto costume, except He's actually in, and the filmmakers knew this, I'm quite sure, he's in the wrong Native American costume. That's a wink to the audience. And he has a sign that says the noble savage in his native habitat. So right away they're telling you, oh, you know, what you've seen before in Hollywood movies, and, you know, in this case it was a radio show, is, you know, a certain ideal of what that era was, what the people and groups that were important in that era.
And we've lost our guest. We have been talking with Michael Agresta. He's a freelance writer based in Los Angeles, and he's here to talk to us about how the Western was lost and why it matters. It's an article he wrote, which appeared in The Atlantic. We have a link to it on our Central Time Facebook page. We'd love to know what you think. Do you enjoy Westerns, or have they kind of fallen out of, appreciation in your mind? Have you fallen out of love with them? You can let us know at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
Were Westerns a big part of your life? Do you have a favorite that you keep going back to? 800-642-1234. Maybe we can get on the line while we try to reestablish contact with Michael Agresta. Maybe talking about a Western with modern space-age phone technology is what's throwing us off here. Wait, I think I see good news, Cynthia.
Yeah, Michael, are you there?
I am, and okay. I'm on a landline, which is, you know, a throwback to the era of the horse and buggy. But
there you go.
Yeah.
Well, so you were talking about the more modern twist to the representation of Tonto, I believe, in The Lone Ranger.
Yeah, so when you meet him, he's in an exhibit in a sideshow, and there's a little sign that says, the noble savage in his native habitat. And that's sort of an acknowledgement of the history of that character and the sometimes racist representation of Native Americans in the source material.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, you know, a sense that we're going to both have fun with it and criticize that history.
Well, as I was reading your article, I was thinking about some of the reasons why perhaps Westerns are falling out of popularity, as you claim. But first, I want to ask, how did you determine that this is truly a trend and not just a case of maybe The Lone Ranger was a bad film?
It's really hard to tell that, because the big budget Westerns that have come out in the past 10 or 15 years, I'm talking the really big budget Westerns, the ones that they're hoping would be, what they call tentpoles now, that would spawn sequels and make hundreds of millions of dollars every summer, they've been really quite bad. In addition to the three we've mentioned, you can go back to Wild Wild West. Hollywood makes a lot of bad movies, but some of those bad movies turn into major commercial successes, and none of these Westerns have. So, you could say four makes a trend. I certainly hope that someone can figure out how to make a successful big-budget Western. The other thing I was going off of is that there seems to be a lot of chatter out of Hollywood right now that people are moving away from Western projects, that it's seen as a bad business decision. And that's partially because of audience reaction in China.
In China?
Yeah, there's a sense that international audiences, from what I've read, particularly Chinese audiences, are less interested in Westerns than other genres.
Hmm. Is that because they're so American, and maybe historically culture might not relate to those stories?
I'm a non-expert on Chinese culture stuff, but my guess would be, it has something to do with the fact that Westerns are so tied up in American history, and maybe even some of the references that might be, very broad, very clear to American audiences would not resonate with foreign audiences.
Well, and it's easy to forget that Hollywood does try to cater to international audiences. The United States isn't the only market.
Yeah, increasingly less easy to forget that.
True.
If you get to see the big budget movies, but it's an important element of the way business is done now.
So, what exactly is taking place of the Westerns? What is what's everyone flocking to instead?
I would say superhero movies has been the big story of the past decade or so. Fighting robot movies. It seems like there have been several echoes of the Transformers franchise recently. And then, to be fair, there have been some successful Westerns. They've tended to be end-of-the-year movies and auteur-driven movies, movies that might not have gotten made if they weren't being directed by directors who had won awards and who had a lot of prestige behind them. Mm-hmm. And there I'm talking about the recent Coen Brothers movies, True Grit and No Country for Old Men, which is arguably an updated Western, and then Django Unchained by Quentin Tarantino, which is also arguably a Western.
Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to think about this, as you mentioned, in a historical context. Westerns became very popular, as early as the 1930s or 40s with the radio dramas of The Lone Ranger and those types of things, and then carrying on into television and then into film. What about our culture might have changed over the span of those decades that has forced the Western to be less relatable to us?
Well, what I tried to hook into was the way that Westerns have tended to reflect and react to America's place in the world and the sort of political flavor of the day. I saw how, in the time between the World Wars and around World War II, you could still do these movies, which were essentially cowboy heroes defending settlements from bad guys, right? Mm-hmm. And that, that's the way we understood our role in those conflicts. As you move through the 50s and into the 60s, especially getting into Vietnam, it becomes much more problematic. The hero is often an anti-hero. There's a lot more sympathy with, say, the Indians. And then in the 80s, there's sort of a quiet moment for Westerns. That revisionist movement from the 70s dies out a little bit in keeping with Reaganism. Then in the 90s, end of the Cold War, there's this big resurgence of Westerns, and it's got this more post-colonial flavor. flavor, which you see with Dances with Wolves. Hmm. Now, the argument I was building is that we're in this Obama-era of Westerns, and that often involves looking at our history and trying to imagine it from a non-male, non-white, non-heterosexual, what have you, the non-dominant position.
Okay, well, we will explore that a little bit after the news and talk about why you think that the Western should be saved. We're talking with Michael Agresta about the fall of the Western in American cinema.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Westerns, love them, hate them, miss them coming out in the theaters. Give us a call. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Verrett. We're continuing our discussion now with Michael Agresta about the fall of the Western. We want to hear from you. Are you a fan of Westerns? What do you make of the decline? Why aren't they making these things anymore? Do you wish they were? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Now, Michael, as we look about this issue of the declining Western, do you think that part of the problem stems from the fact that current Westerns are simply lacking an iconic actor to portray that cowboy?
That's a good question. You know, definitely, you know, Kevin Costner emerged as a iconic cowboy in the 90s. You had Clint Eastwood, and he's still around. Beyond that, you know, various actors have tried their hands. I'm not sure if anyone has really stuck with the cowboy image as his sort of like main go-to role. Mm-hmm. Nothing really comes to mind for me. So that could be. But I would imagine that if audiences wanted it, an actor would find his way into that position.
And, well, we were just talking off the air here in the studio about the possibility. What if they kind of threw a twist in there and came up with a cowgirl? Would that
resonate? Well, True Grit did do that, and True Grit was fairly successful for its budget, quite successful in the box office as an end-of-the-year prestige movie. That was a younger girl who proved her mettle as a, you know, riding with a cowboy. There's a very small movie called Meek's Cutoff, which is very interesting and good, but hardly anybody saw it. That's Michelle Williams played a woman on a wagon train. And there may be others that I'm missing. It's the argument I'm making, you know, about what this era demands of cowboy movies and of Westerns. You know, that really fits in with it. I think that to make the major Western of this era, you would want to think about, you know, what about women in that time? What about, you know, the experience of Native American people at that time, the experience of Black people, et cetera.
Let's take a call from Bonnie in Waukesha. Hi, Bonnie.
Hello.
What's your question or comment?
Yeah, the older Westerns, and I'm old enough to remember these being on TV, is The Lone Ranger and a lot of the Westerns starring Randolph Scott and Cisco Kid type of things. A lot of those back then, they used deductive reasoning and investigation as part of the storyline. They weren't just bang-bang shoot-em-ups. And even Jay Silverheels put in a great performance as Tonto, and Tonto as also participated in the deductive reasoning and even at times went in disguise to scope out a situation that the Lone Ranger was going to be getting into prior to the Lone Ranger going there. And so they used intelligence along with their, you know, riding horses and action. But nowadays everything just seems to be, you know, let's shoot somebody.
Thanks, Bonnie. What do you think about that observation, Michael?
Yes, I think it's just the story of modern-day blockbusters in general, and that certainly includes modern-day blockbuster Westerns. The TV form especially lends itself to investigation, to that sort of deductive mystery based storyline. But certainly in all of these movies we've talked about, there is some central mystery, and the Lone Ranger movie, the recent movie, does involve uncovering a secret plot. So in that way, it is in keeping, but it's definitely overwhelmed by the explosions.
Well, and it sounds, one thing that I'm thinking about here after listening to Bonnie's comment is, what if it's a matter of the Westerns falling victim to sort of a chicken and egg cycle of stereotypes? And when we think about what a Western is, if you were to just ask someone to describe it in a line, they would say, good guys, bad guys, and lots of guns. And really deducing the plot and stripping away some of the intelligence that might actually be there. Do you think that that's one reason people might be staying away? They might just assume they already know what the storyline is and they don't want to bother wasting their time with it.
It could be. And that's one thing that made me want to write the article, actually, was, having friends, who didn't grow up in the golden age of the Western, who are a little dismissive of the genre in general, and they look at, even thinking about movies from the golden age of the revisionist Western, the 60s and 70s, late 60s and 70s, even then they sort of expect, a heroic cowboy figure to be, vanquishing the bad guys. And that's just not what the genre became in the second half of the 20th century. And, I really encourage all the listeners to, go pull out a great Western. It's a genre with just so much to tell us about our history and about, who we are as Americans.
And I would imagine a lot of people are uncomfortable, though, with our history. And we even hear that we air an old-time radio drama series here on the Ideas Network on the weekends. And sometimes we get comments from listeners about the fact that we're airing old programs that still contain some racist language or, characterize Native Americans in a light that is really inappropriate in today's era to think about. So what do you say to that about maybe American queasiness with going in to see the Westerns now?
Yeah, I see Westerns as both the residual language of, America's sense of righteousness from, going back to Manifest Destiny, right? The fact that, we deserve the continent and we are, the best caretakers of whatever people live here already. But it's also the language of America as a culture, as a society, maturing into the 21st century, through the late 20th century, and sort of revisiting those ideas and thinking them through more, seeing some problems in it. And especially as you watch movies from 1950 on and, getting into the 60s and 70s, it's just you can see the wheels turning and, people really problematizing violence, problematizing the image of the cowboy hero to the point when, you have things totally turned on their head with something like Django Unchained or True Grit.
Let's talk to Ivan in Wausau next. Hi, Ivan.
Hello. I just wanted to make a comment. When I turn on a Western from the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s versus the new ones they make today, just looking at it, even the color and the picture itself is so different than the newer ones that are made now. And the great character actors back in the day, Jack Elam, in a lot of great old Westerns, supporting roles, John Anderson, Richard Anderson, I believe, is one of the other ones that played a lot of the Rifleman series and movies. It was just such a different flavor to me than the newer ones now. It's hard to duplicate those from the earlier day.
Thanks, Ivan. Michael, your thoughts?
Yeah, I would not expect or hope that we can duplicate that era. It certainly was, it was the preeminent genre of much of that time, and it got the best talent. It had many productions of those kinds of movies going on all the time, and people were able to really, like John Wayne and the character actors that you mentioned, really develop personas expertise in that genre, and John Ford, the director, obviously, warrants mention. Now it's more something that a director might have to fight to get made, or an actor, you know, whoever really wants to see the movie made. And it is a different kind of thing. But there are still good, excellent Westerns being made, just really more in the art house world.
Mm. So, Michael, why do you say that America needs Westerns now more than ever before?
Well, I think that it has to do with this time we're going through. You know, our place in the world is changing. I certainly don't know where we're headed or what the future holds, but it's a time when we're sort of rethinking ourselves in a world that feels a little bit less unipolar, as opposed to, say, the early 90s when there was a big spike in popular Westerns. And one of the big challenges of this time, and one of the challenges that we as a nation, to me it feels like we, Barack Obama, in a way, is an emblem of this. We've decided to, you know, really investigate our relationship to some of these tricky questions of otherness. And the question of otherness is central to the Western. It's all about, moving. It's all about frontier situations. So I think that the Western is really an ideal language for thinking through some of, you know, the stuff that we're working through as a nation right now. But it may not be, you know, popcorn fodder exactly.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Michael Agresta is a freelance writer based in Los Angeles. His piece, How the Western Was Lost and Why It Matters, appeared in The Atlantic, and we've got it linked to our Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up next, we'll be talking about the annual Perseids meteor shower currently taking place. We'll try to figure out where we can go to get a good view. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This weekend, the annual Perseid meteor shower peaked with as many as 100 meteors blazing through the sky every hour. NASA says the Perseids produce more streaks of light than any other meteor shower.
Well, here to explain what the Perseid meteor shower is and why it happens is Bill Andrews, associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha, Wisconsin. Hi, Bill.
Hi. How's it going?
Good, and we're loving the Perseids. So what is the meteor shower? Tell us about it.
Sure. Well, a meteor shower in general is just whenever there are a bunch of meteors that appear in the sky together, not necessarily at the same moment, but over the night, and it looks like they're all coming from the same point. They're all radiating from the same part of the sky. And so that happens a few times a year and at regular intervals, and right now we're in the midst of the Perseid meteor shower, named after the constellation Perseus, which is the where it looks like all the meteors are coming from this time.
So why does it happen around the same time each year?
Well, it's because the origin of the meteors themselves, and just to be clear, the meteor in this context means the light that you see in the sky. So a meteor shower is a bunch of these lights streaking across. They're also called shooting stars or falling stars if you're being pessimistic. And the reason they happen at the same time every year is because what causes them is the little dust particles that comets give off in the solar system as they're making their rounds around the sun. And so in particular, the Perseid meteor shower comes from the comet named Swift-Tuttle, which comes every 130 years or so, and these things are dusty enough and gaseous enough that they leave these kind of little breadcrumbs wherever they go. The comets do. And so it does that in front of Earth's orbit so that whenever our planet crosses the comet's orbit, which happens at the same point every year, that's when we see all the dust and all the other little particles coming into our atmosphere above us. And so that's why they're so regular, because it's literally at the same point in the solar system every year.
Okay, I have a dumb question.
Sure, no, no such thing.
Is it the same comet every year?
It is the debris of the same comet every year. But again, the comet itself is a rare one. Some of the other famous meteor showers are due to other famous comets. For example, Comet Halley is the result, actually causes some of the other famous meteor showers.
But that debris, that dust, you said it comes every 130 years, and the debris is just sitting there waiting for us to whap into it each time we loop around to August?
Yeah, that's right. These things are big messes. They leave behind all this dust and all these little particles behind so much that we can just keep plowing into them year after year.
Sloppy.
Yeah.
It needs to clean up after itself. So what part of the sky is this emanating from? Where should we be looking if we want to see it?
Sure. Well, the quickest answer I can say is toward the northeast. If you know your sky, and you know precious few people do these days, it's coming from the constellation Perseus, and particular from its border with Cassiopeia. But basically, that just means you can look toward the northeast, and after midnight is when it'll get clearer and clearer, because the dynamics of how Earth's orbit works makes it, you know, the streaks of light appear that much brighter. And so as the night goes on, the constellation Perseus moves higher and higher up into the sky. And so your best views are actually going to come shortly before daybreak, so early in the mornings. And so if you just, meteor showers are great because you can just lie back. You can just kind of appreciate the whole sky at once. You don't need to bother with a telescope or with binoculars or any kind of expensive stuff. All you need is a clear sky, so no clouds. We've been pretty lucky with that lately. And just you can get a futon or a bark lounger or a sleeping bag or whatever, and then you can just appreciate the whole sky at once. And as you said earlier, we should be, ideally, we could be getting 100 of these meteors per night, per hour, excuse me. So that's under ideal conditions, if you're at a dark site, so, you know, if up north maybe, or far away from the bright city lights. If you're closer to one of the cities, it's still going to be pretty good, but you're only going to get about 60 to 80, so still more than one a minute.
So I was out looking at them on Saturday night, and I was just struck by how, I guess, the variety of them. They're coming from all different directions. Some were really bright, and some were very faint, and you had to be looking in just the right spot to see it. Mm-hmm. What determines how bright it is?
Well, mostly it's what it's made of and how big the little particle is that is causing the light. So even though it's all coming from the same original body, from this comet Swift-Tuttle, comets are messy enough that they aren't all just one solid piece of material that's just flaking off. It can have a lot of different kind of bits and pieces to it made of different things. So different materials will burn differently, will appear differently, and bigger pieces will shine brighter because they're up there longer and they'll encounter more air friction, which is what causes them to heat up and glow and making the light in the first place. So it's the size and the makeup of these things that can cause all that great diversity in how they look.
Bill, as a guy who goes out and watches meteor showers, including the Perseids, aren't we just setting ourselves up for frustration? It's cloudy, or we're in the city and it's too bright. There are so many ways to be foiled in trying to see these darn things.
Well, in a way, but I mean, that's true. That's true of so much of life. And I feel like in terms of looking to the sky for cool stuff, which is something I always recommend people do, meteor showers are a pretty good bet. As long, like I said, if it is overcast, then you're kind of out of luck. But these days it isn't overcast too much. And then the whole sky is open to you. It's literally the whole universe can unfold before your eyes. And so when we have specific things like this we can look forward to, we're able to know more or less what we're expecting, and usually they don't disappoint. Usually, as long as there aren't clouds or, you know, stadiums, lights in your face, if you've got at least decent conditions, it'll still be a really impressive, kind of awe-inspiring show.
And we shouldn't look straight up to the sky?
You can look straight up to the sky. You should basically just kind of have an open view toward the sky in general, as much of it as you can.
Okay.
If you do happen to be in a bright place, or if the moon is still up, and we're lucky this year because the moon is isn't very bright, and it sets really early. But if it does happen to be up, or if there is like a searchlight nearby, just try to block that with the side of a building or with trees or something if you can. And then the rest of the sky that's open to you, you should be able to see the meteor streak across all of it. And so it isn't just this one point that it looks like they're all coming from there, but you're able to see them go streak out across all the rest of the sky. So if you're lying back and you've got kind of the whole heavens open before you, then you're able to get a really nice show and see almost everything that would happen up there.
looking ahead, what kinds of things can we expect in the sky soon? Any other big meteor showers or astronomical events on the horizon?
Sure. Well, there are a couple more meteor showers this year. We've got the Orionids in October and the Leonids in November and the Geminids in December. Those are some of the kind of famous big ones in the astronomy community. But unfortunately, this year, they're kind of drowned out by the moon a little bit, so they're not going to be really amazing shows. But we do have what should be a really amazing show coming up, which is Comet Ison. I don't know, in my world, we've been hearing about this nonstop. Some of us are already kind of sick of it. But it's still a really big deal, because Comet Ison is poised to be one of the biggest, brightest comets that we've seen, potentially in generations, in hundreds of years, possibly.
When's that coming?
That'll be appearing in late November is when it actually will be at its brightest. If you've got your binoculars, your telescope, you can search it out already now and look for it, and you can see it kind of as a distant speck. But as it gets closer to the sun especially, which will be able to really brighten it up for us, it might even get big enough, bright enough so that we could see it during the daylight hours. It might be brighter than Venus, which is really, really bright. Some predictions even say it might be brighter than the full moon. It could have a tail stretching across half of the sky.
Sweet.
We try not to oversell it, because with comets, you really never know. And so this time, it could be setting us up for disappointment. So we're just going to say that even at the weakest estimates, it should still be the brightest comet we've seen in 25 years or so. So Comet Ison coming up later this year will be quite a show.
Sounds like something we'd want to keep at a safe distance, though, as well.
Right.
So it sounds like there's a lot to look forward to. If we're interested in becoming somewhat of an amateur astronomer, can you give us some tips on how to get started in just our last minute here?
Sure. Well, there's usually we've got a bunch of amateur astronomy communities, a bunch of clubs nearby that you can talk to. They're usually very friendly people. You've got a lot of websites. NASA if you can navigate all their various websites, they've got a lot of useful tips, too, and the Internet can often give you all kinds of other pointers. And I could also just give a healthy plug for Discover Magazine's sister publication, Astronomy Magazine, at astronomy.com, which also has a bunch of these other tips and what you can see and how you can see it best.
Well, thank you so much for being with us, Bill.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That was Bill Andrews. He's associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha.
We want to hear your stories, by the way. If you can head over to the Central Time Facebook page, have you been out and made a successful viewing of the Perseids this year? Do you always try to go out and catch comets? Or are you headed out there maybe tonight? Go over to the Central Time Facebook page. And by the way, we had a lot of interest in that show on Westerns, I hear. If you have a favorite Western to recommend, a great movie that you think all of us should check out, Central Time Facebook page is a great way to do that,
so,
too.
Rob, did you go out and look at the meteors?
No, well, it was too cloudy last night, yeah. Oh. You've been out on Saturday.
I went on Saturday night, and I think I'm going to get up early tomorrow and catch him again. So,
good luck.
Thanks.
Hope to get clear skies. Coming up next, we're going to talk about why college enrollment is declining in the United States. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Cynthia Schuster. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.